This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hello listeners, and today I'm speaking to Maggie Adairan-Pocock, who is a space scientist and educator, president of the British Science Association and managing director of Science Innovation Limited. But for most of our listeners, she's probably best known as the presenter of the Sky at Night TV show, along with Chris Lintott. So, Maggie, you have had an incredibly wide and varied career over the years. Can you tell me a bit more about your career and how you got into that line of work?
Yes, I think you're right. My career has been wide and varied. And all my life, I've been fascinated by space. And that started, well, there was a combination of things. I don't remember the moon landings, but I remember hearing about them, getting very excited about them. And that, combined with the clangers, seemed to be the magic spot that got me sort of hooked on space. And so going to school, I went to 13 different schools, so my education was a bit checkered. And I also have a condition called dyslexia. I used to say I suffer from it, but I can see some of the benefits of it now. Mm-hmm. And so all this made a sort of the idea of a career in space seem like almost like a distant dream. But I think having a crazy dream can really help. And via a convoluted route, going via the MOD, working within universities, eventually getting a job in ground-based astronomy, then working in space-based astronomy for a while, I was able to sort of map a career and to get me where I wanted to be.
And so you talked about there about your passion starting with, you know, people talking about the moon landings and the clangers. Is the moon a particularly fond place in the universe for you?
Well, I do define myself as a self-certified lunatic. Because all my life, I think it started from my father, because he used to tell me about the moon in Africa. And he was to say how beautiful it was and how he used to sort of cycle over unmetalled roads with no streetlights. And when the moon was up and full, it was, you know, guided his way. So it was definitely a friend of my father. And then I was brought up mainly in London. And you don't see that many stars because of the light pollution and things like that. Mm. But sometimes you do get a glorious view of the moon, you know, over the old city. So that was sort of definitely endeared me. And now I've passed on my lunacy. So I got it from my father. I've passed on my lunacy to my daughter. And sometimes we live out in Guildford now. Sometimes we step outside in the garden and look right, look left and howl at the moon. So lunacy is definitely strong in our family.
How are you feeling about this? Because this year we've got a whole run of, we being the world, there's a whole run of spacecraft going towards the moon, some of them leading up to the Artemis mission, some of them just, you know, other nations are heading that way. Are you particularly excited about those missions coming up?
Yes, because it's the moon, and I did actually write a book about the moon. You see, I mentioned I'm dyslexic, and so writing about things is always a challenge for me. But I did write a book about the moon because I love the moon so much. It just made it a lot easier because I could write about what I was passionate about. But so the idea of people sort of going back to the moon. I mean, I think the last humans on the moon was back in 1972. Mm. So we've waited a long time, and there's been this ongoing discussion: do we go to the moon? Do we go to Mars? And that has almost been a hiatus in terms of stopping us going anywhere.
Yeah.
And so the fact that people say, yes, okay, we're going to go back to the moon, I find incredibly exciting. And especially Artemis, because they have promised to put a woman on the moon, because so far it's only been 12 men. And I think someone from an ethnic minority and possibly someone with a disability. And I can sign up for all three. So I keep on putting my hand up, but they haven't contacted me yet.
I do know that the European Space Agency definitely is doing some work with trying to get more disabled astronauts, particularly people with physical disabilities. Yes. So hopefully, maybe you'll get your chance in the future. And obviously, as you said, Artemis is going to be sending the first woman to the surface of the moon. You yourself have done quite a lot of work with encouraging both women and girls, as well as young people in general, into the space field. How is this, and why is this important to you?
So I think it's breaking down the stereotypes. I call it sort of the taxi scenario, because sometimes I hop into a cab and I'm sitting in back there, and the taxi driver said, so what do you do? I said, oh, I'm a space scientist. I said, you what? And I get a double take, because I don't look like a quintessential space scientist. I think they expect sort of a guy, you know, a white guy with a beard, you know, sort of. And so it's trying to break those stereotypes down. And because of this, it means that there are some girls out there who aren't considering careers in STEM, in space, in general. And so we're missing out. It shows that when you have diverse teams, companies do so much better. And so it's trying to get this diversity into science across the board, but especially into sort of a computing, engineering, a sort of physics, these subjects, where there is a deficit of girls, and we have a deficit of people coming into these subjects. So it's a win-win situation, really.
And how do you go about trying to sort of encourage these groups of people to get more involved in space?
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, I do try and encourage everybody, because we just need more scientists, full stop. Mm-hmm. But I do sort of try and target sort of a specific messages. And so a few years ago, we had International Year of Astronomy, and we were looking at female astronomers. And we could go back, I think sort of it was about 6,000 years to the first female astronomer. And hers was the first female name to be written in the history books. Now, I can never pronounce her name because I'm dyslexic, but I think it was Eduhanna. And so this was the first name written in the history book, first female name written in the history books. And she wrote poetry about sort of measuring arcs across the sky and looking at the stars. And so we have a long history of women in astronomy. And it's just trying to show that, I think I always feel that astronomy was got a bit dominated by white guys in togas. And that seems to be the font of all information. But I'm writing a book at the moment for BBC Books at the moment, looking at constellations and the stars. And it's very interesting to see, you know, we've got the standard, you know, sort of recognised constellations that have been recognised by International Astronomical Union. But there are many more constellations which other cultures came up with. And so if you take something like Orion, different cultures saw different pictures with that sort of particular set of stars. So the stars are the history of everyone, sort of a male, female, and across the world. And so it's just trying to sell that to people and show them that, yeah, it wasn't just white guys in togas.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
And as you said, diversity across the board has been shown to help pretty much every industry that people go into. But do you think that learning about space benefits people as individuals as well?
I very much think so. And so that's why sometimes I go to a school and they say, oh, well, perhaps you should only speak to the gifted and talented or something like that. Mm. And when I go to a school, I want to speak to everyone, because I think space and an understanding of the universe is just something fundamental in all of us. And it was quite interesting during lockdown, because many people were sort of stuck at home, they couldn't get out. And I was invited to do quite a few television sort of interviews and also radio interviews, talking about looking up at the night sky. Because sometimes if you're feeling enclosed in and sort of, you know, hemmed in, and if you had a busy day and you haven't been out, just sort of getting a view of the night sky can really transform someone's mood. So, and I think it's a sort of, it's philosophical. It's like music and art and all those wonderful things. Understanding our place in the universe and how that understanding has evolved over the years, I think, is also very critical for all of us. So, another factor as well is that jobs in tech pay well. And so we were talking about sort of some of the things that I've done in my career. My career has enabled me to sort of, you know, work on climate change and travel around the world speaking to people. And it seems a shame that quite a bit of the population is missing out on these opportunities. So diversity is good for everybody, but people working in STEM generally have a sort of a more fruitful careers.
I will definitely say that my by working and talking to people about space has taken me all over the place as well. If anybody listening is thinking about it, the travel is quite good.
Do it. And also, it's good to remember that space, one of the things that people often think is, oh, well, to be to work in space, I have to be a scientist or an engineer. And the STEM, it plays a vital role in space. But we also have lawyers, you know, PR people. There's a whole, and the space industry is, sorry, I'm turning into a sales pitch, but I get very excited about space. But this industry is also growing, especially in the UK. So I think anyone who's got an interest in this subject and should come along, because we need everybody.
Absolutely. I can't agree more. There's dozens of different things that people can get involved with. And of course, one of the things that most of our listeners are going to know you best for is your work as one of the co-presenters of Sky at Night. Did you watch the show when you were younger?
Very much so. And it's funny because I was mentioning that I grew up in London. Patrick used to give me sort of an insight into what I might be able to see. And so I'd sort of sit down and sort of listen to the program. I used to get special permission to stay up late and watch the program. And then I sort of go outside, and I was living in sort of a Belsize Park, which is quite close to Hampstead Heath. And on the way back from school, sometimes it would be dark and I'd be able to have a sort of a clear view of the night sky because, you know, you didn't have too many buildings in front of me. And so I think, oh my goodness, Patrick mentioned that and I can see it. So he brought the night sky alive to me. And so that was just sort of a wonderful legacy for me. But yes, I did used to watch the program as a child and love it as well.
Does it feel good to be bringing the night sky alive for other people now as well?
Yes, but slightly daunting. When I got the job to do the presenting, I think especially in the first episode, I was very much like a rabbit in the headlights because, you know, this is the iconic Sky at Night television program. And he's little Maggie, you know. Presenting the program. And so there was a little girl in me that was very excited, but also sort of that moment of terror. I thought, oh my goodness, those were very big boots to fill.
I should imagine carrying a show that's been running for, I think at the moment it's 65 years, is quite, yes, a lot of responsibility.
Yes, but also it was nice to be welcomed into the family because Chris Linter has been doing it, and also Pete Lawrence had been doing it for many years. So although I was the new kid on the block, I was welcomed into the family.
Oh, that's great to hear. And how did you come to be standing there like a deer in headlights? How did you come to present the show?
I think it was quite interesting because Patrick had done the program for 57 years, the longest serving TV presenter in the world, and also sort of the longest running television program in the world. And I did mention that I would love to do it, but I didn't think anything would come of it. At that time, I'd done quite a bit of work with the BBC. I'd made a documentary about the moon and about satellites, and over the years, I've done lots of science communication. I think it's probably a bit higher now. I've probably seen about 370,000 kids in the last sort of 12 to 14 years.
So, wow. That's a big number.
Well, I'm quite lucky because I do something called GCSE Science Live. So it used to start with maybe 50 kids in a primary school classroom. And but now I do sort of big events. Like, so there's something called GCSE Science Live, and you get 2,000 15-year-olds in an auditorium. Yeah. And so the numbers can rack up quite quickly there. Yes, I've been doing all these different sorts of science communication, science festivals, sort of going into schools. And so I was hoping that my credentials would be good enough. And then I remember I was filming a television program for CBeebies called sort of Stargazing. And CBeebies Stargazing. And the call came through saying, would you like to do the program? And I was like, oh, a moment of great excitement for me.
And With the show, you've been, because The Sky at Night has always been at the forefront of some of the most incredible aspects of space exploration and space science. Are there any particular like historic moments that you've been part of that particularly stand out for you?
Very much so. And oh, yes, actually, I can think of three spring to mind automatically. And the first one was being at the European Space Agency. And I remember, I think it was Armistice Day, I can't remember the year, but it's when the Philae lander landed on, Churyumov Gerasimenko. I could never say it at the time, but I practiced so much, it's stuck in my mind.
67P Churyumov Gerasimenko. I still know how to spell it to this day.
I know.
Yes. Which is quite
that
a challenge.
That will be stuck in my mind forever, yes.
Yes, that was in 2014 for our listeners at home.
2014, yes. And so it was, I suppose, still relatively new on the programme. And it was just wonderful to be part of the press team and sort of go out there. And we were in Darmstadt for a while. And then I think we went to Cologne. And we were getting the latest information. Also, we'd been in the UK speaking to some of the people who were making the instrumentation. Now, as my history is in making instrumentation for space, but also for ground-based telescopes. So to be able to speak to the instrument engineers here in the UK, then go out. And also, that was a roller coaster ride of a journey. It's landed. Oh, no, the harpoons. So to be there and see that unfolding right before our eyes was brilliant. Another one that springs to mind is we did a television program looking at sort of a space and astronomy at the Vatican. And so for this, we went actually inside Vatican City and we were speaking to these priest astronomers who were showing us various artifacts. And so just being firstly in Italy with the glorious weather, but being in Italy and sort of going behind the velvet ropes and going sort of into sort of places where people don't usually get to go. And just and looking at that sort of juxtaposition between sort of religion and science and again, talking about Galileo and all sorts of those historical moments. So that was sort of very iconic for me. And then the third one, I think, was New Horizon, as it sort of approached Pluto. We went to a NASA headquarters and were there as New Horizon sort of approached sort of a Pluto and started getting those images in. So again, a sort of a amazing moments of sort of scientific discovery.
So as we said at the beginning, you've had an absolutely wide and varied career, and I very much hope that continues. And you continue to encourage more people into space because it is a wonderful thing to learn about, as I'm sure everybody listening will agree. So thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to talk to us, Maggie.
Oh, it was my absolute pleasure. Lovely to speak to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.